Subcommittee on Human Services will now come to order, and Tim, have you had everybody?
No, I haven't.
Will you guys just kind of introduce yourself? This is Tim, who is head of Board of Nursing there. Would you tell us about it?
Yes, Senator Bill Morissette from Lynn County.
Okay. Hi, I'm Senator Alan Bates. You and I have met on another committee, so we know each other. Let's see.
Good afternoon. Abel Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County.
Introduce myself?
Yeah.
I know who he is.
Okay,
no,
forget it.
I don't. I'm Representative Gerard from County Falls. Nice to meet you.
Senator Westland is in a very important meeting and will be excused. And so I think I said, Tina Kotak. And Nick,
Representative Nathanson, they would both need to be introduced. So you should suitably embarrass them when they show up.
When they show up, that's right. But Representative Kotak has a family emergency, and so she won't be joining us today. So everybody keep in mind and careful thinking about Tina Kotak, please. Thank you. And Tim, if you will, introduce us to the bill and proceed with our hearing. Thanks.
We have a hearing on Senate Bill 5528 for the Oregon Board of Nursing. And representing the Oregon Board of Nursing today will be Joan Bouchard, the Executive Director, and Kim Cobrain, the Investigations and Compliance Program Executive. And I will turn it over to you at this point.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
May I say something? May I make a statement?
Excuse me, may.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
You may or may not be aware of some of the controversy that went on with the Board of Nursing. We did have several hearings in my committee during the interim. I did talk with the Attorney General. They did do an audit, and I met with the board, or Joan and Kim, and to let them know that I think everything is okay. I think we have resolved some of the issues that came up during the interim about the oversight of nurses and other people that they cover. And I wanted to make this statement early on to reassure them that I wasn't waiting to ambush them somewhere along the way. I admire the program that they put together. We met. I think it's a model program that other boards and commissions should follow. In fact, I do have a bill that would require all boards and commissions to keep track of complaints when they come in, how many complaints are resolved before the end of the year, how many complaints are carried over, what the penalties are, that kind of information that the Board of Contractors and all boards would have to comply with. It's a kind of a super performance measure, and I, in fact, go so far as to say I would like to use their program as a model that they've been putting together. So what occurred did get a lot of media attention in the journey. We did, Senator Bowie was present at some of the hearings, and so I just wanted to know that I think things are going well, and they're going to refer to some of the, you know, to the audit, to the recommendations, and some of that. So I just wanted to make that statement up front.
Thank you, Senator. Mm-hmm. Any other comments that someone has that people can that you'd like to express?
Representative Boone. Maybe we'll talk about it later, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Good.
Okay.
Very good.
Representative?
Morgan?
Well, just to bring to your attention, Madam Chair, that Representative Nathanson is now here.
Oh! And Representative Nathanson, since you have arrived, and nobody is looking at time, certainly not Representative Morgan and me, but we did introduce ourselves to Tim. And so would you just introduce yourself and let Tim know?
Tim, I took my tray back to the food line.
No explanation necessary.
I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13, which is North Eugene.
Thank you so much. We always need a little levity, don't we? Senator Bates and then Senator Wardley.
Just to make a quick statement of personal interest here. I don't know what you guys want in your budget, but whatever you want, you got it.
and the reason is, you
have connections in my life that can make my life a living hell.
I thought I was being nice.
If nurses in the hospital turn against me, I'm dead meat.
Bring these guys chocolate a lot.
It's worse than that. At 3 o'clock in the morning, they could just kill me if they want. The one thing I am concerned about, and I'm going to tell you that I think you've done a great job, and we have a nursing shortage, as everybody knows, and to bring new nurses in and to get them, you know, registered, ready to go, background checks, has been a heck of a job over the last 3 or 4 years. And we are not seeing, I don't think, the nursing shortage to be expected in some ways, because you guys have filled the gap so well. Not saying you have any problems, not concerns, but overall, a huge influx in dealing with this problem. You did a great job. And I will put that in context when we look at your budgets here.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Brebe, thank you very much. If you could help me find in your materials, I will be looking for the report compliance around Senate Bill 756 from, I think, 3 sessions ago. Increasing diversity in the board and in the profession. Is that in the documents that we have?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, it is. It's in the handouts that we gave you today. Okay. And it's in supplemental material part one. And it's about in the middle. Let me see. Right here, it's like this. It calls change in ethnic background of licensees from 2001 to 2006. And then I also included a report on what the nursing profession has done in the state around trying to increase workforce diversity.
Great. Thank
and
you.
And so that report is in there, as well as the statistics for the Oregon nurses.
Thank you. This isn't the time for me now that if others might have some concerns or questions they want the board to answer, that what I really want to see happen is that as much as we possibly can to give them time to bring back their answers. If you have any that you'd like to promote at this time, certainly feel free to do that. Otherwise, we will begin with the hearing, and at the close of each person's statement, unless it's a burning question that you need to ask on a point they're making, then I would prefer that you wait until the end of each person's presentation. For the question statement, thank you very much, Ms. Bouchard.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd also like to introduce Pat Miles, who's at the table. She's our business manager, and Erica Klinger, who is the Department of Administrative Services budget analyst that we've worked with this year, and she's been delightful to work with. We appreciate her help. So we do have kind of a slideshow today. We're going to quickly introduce you to the Board of Nursing and then go into our performance measurements, of which we have quite a few. So just to quickly introduce you to the Board of Nursing, we have been around since 1911, and the mission of the board, of course, is protection of the public. So our mission statement actually says that we're here to safeguard the public's health and well-being and providing guidance for and regulation of entry into the practice and nursing education and continuing safe practice. And we do that by establishing standards for nursing practice and nursing education in this state. We're one of the largest regulatory boards in the state. We regulate more than 62,000 individual licensees. And some of those licensees have more than one license, so we actually are monitoring 67,000 licensees. And these include registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, certified registered nurse anesthetists, certified nursing assistants, and certified medication aides. And during our presentation, we'll be referring to all these seven groups as our licensees. We'll include all of them. We are going to talk a little bit about what are the key budget drivers for our agency. And the factors that drive our OSBN budget and Board of Nursing budget can be described as program services that we provide and also the needs of licensees and certificate holders. in our program services, traditionally the board has provided three primary services. Those are licensing of qualified applicants, discipline for violations of the Nursing Practice Act, and accreditation of nursing education programs. And today, maintaining these services continues to be the core of the agency's purpose to provide public safety, and it constitutes the most significant budget drivers for our agency. This gives you an idea of what our licensing volume is for our licensing and certification department. And it tells you in fiscal year of 2006, this is the kind of volume that we have in terms of licenses. We license those people to ensure that those who hold an active license meet the specific knowledge and competency requirements, and that they have not engaged in any criminal behavior or unprofessional behavior that would pose a risk to those in their care. Each of the seven licensee types have their own requirements for licensure, and it's based on the scope of work that each licensee does. And each of these applications must be reviewed and evaluated to be sure that these people continue to meet the standards. As a result of increased mobility of nursing and the globalization of healthcare, the cost of processing licensure applications for the board is on the rise. Also, the increase of international nurses and graduates of non-organ accredited programs are increasing, and they require a greater review, a depth of review, than do graduates from, of course, the organ programs. Additionally, in the last couple of years, we've had new categories of licensees added to the board, for example, the clinical nurse specialists. And we also have had new statutes added that we are responsible for regulating. And examples of that is the nurse practitioners and the clinical nurse specialists getting dispensing privileges and prescriptive privileges. And also, we now have mandatory continuing education requirement for pain management. So all of those issues have also impacted the licensing and certification. Also, our licensing and certification department also includes examination processes for nurses and nursing assistants. And technology has really made an impact there. 12 years ago, we used to test registered nurses and licensed practical nurses two times a year. We'd bring them to the old Memorial Coliseum, and they would stay there for 2 days, and they could only take the test for two times a year. And now we do computer-based testing where they can test year-round. So that has really helped to get nurses on the job quicker. Also, in terms of another factor that's driving our licensing costs is the cost of certified nursing assistants. Federal law requires that when we examine the certified nursing assistants, that they have to take both a paper and pencil test a multiple choice test as well as a manual skills test. So the manual skills test is very expensive and time consuming and has added to the cost of our examinations in this area.
Joan, excuse me for a moment. That's going to become one of the issues of this budget, and we will have a reason to get that with some resolution. So.
And, of course, Senator Bates had referred to just the nursing shortage has added to the workload of the board in the last couple of years. We all know that the population in Oregon is growing, and as more people come into Oregon, there's more demand for nurses. Also, there's the aging population in Oregon, and just as Oregonians in general are aging, nurses are also aging. The average age of an RN in the state is now 48 years old. For LPNs, it's 49. That's average is 48 years old. For LPNs, it's 49. For nurse practitioners, it's 50. And 50% of our RNs are over 50 years of age, and 13% are over the age of 60. So you can see that this is going to be a huge factor in how many nurses we're going to have in the coming years. Now we're bringing more and more into the pipeline. We've been very successful in doing this, but we have to keep in mind that we are going to be losing a lot of nurses in the next few years due to retirement. And the average age of the nursing faculty is even worse. The average age of nursing faculty in the state is 52. years of age. So we've got some issues that are coming down the pike. As I said, we're doing better about getting nurses into the pipeline. The recruitment for nursing has been very successful, but we don't have enough to fill with its coming need in the years ahead. And just things are happening in the state. For example, have we heard that in the state hospital is going to be projecting a need for up to 400 psychiatric nurses to fill the state hospitals that they're building. And the governor's task force on long-term care is recommending up to 400 new CNAs for long-term care in the next few years. So our population base of nurses is going to continue to grow, and that affects the licensing and certification volume that we have in the state. And we do try to get the nurses on the job as quickly as we can when they do apply to the board.
Senator Bates?
I'm not quite sure I heard something right there. Were you predicting that we'll need 400 new RN nurses for the forensic patients in
Mental
Health Hospital?
That is what has been stated from Bob Nichols at this, yes. Who's working on the state hospital. Now, whether we can get 400 psychiatric nurses, I don't think that's reality, but we have to look at new ways then. What other models of care can we use, you know, to fill that need?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So John, I think that's, well, I'll wait till you get to then, because I want to talk about collaborative models, and we'll talk about that.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Another program of the Board of Nursing is for discipline and disciplinary investigations, and it's a major part of the Board of Nursing. In addition to conducting more than 1,500 criminal background investigations per year on applicants who come to the attention to either self-disclosing a criminal conviction on their application, or we put every application we get through the law enforcement database system, we have more than 1,500 criminal investigations, and we investigate every one of those complaints. We also have approximately 700 conduct complaint investigations a year. And these investigation costs are, of course, driven because they're staff-intensive and time-consuming in nature. On the slide, I've given you an idea of the types of complaints that... first of all, we're doing the sources of complaints that come into the board office. And as you can see, that the number one source of complaints into the board office is employers of nurses at 28%. Then the next second source of complaints are actually our licensing and certification department, and that is the result of the LEDS checks and the self-disclosures. The third source of complaints for the board is consumers and family members of patients. And then other nurses or co-workers of nurses are the fourth largest source of complaint.
We're trying to find out, where is this in your material that you gave us?
That's important. Madam Chair, in the supplemental materials part 3, we have several statistics on discipline, and you'll find that at the beginning of that section.
Okay. Give us a few minutes to get there, because that's good information.
It's really more towards the back of your packet, and it's the colored graphs. Part 3, these are three parts to the supplemental materials, and this is in part 3.
And you're talking about...
Oh, it's in part 2? Part 3, okay.
By notebook, this is...
Okay. It's in the front of your desk.
Okay.
And it turns to part 3.
Immediately after the KPM.
Okay.
There you go.
Gotcha.
And then it looks like this?
Yes. Thank you. I think we're all there now.
Okay. Thanks.
You see the material outside of your folder. Okay.
Go ahead.
Continue, thanks.
So that pie graph shows you the sources of complaints that come into the board.
The next slide
shows the...
Joan, can you go back for the first minute, since we're all busy looking for this, and I hate to have you repeat yourself, but if you could just, since we are now on page with you, can you just go back over that?
This chart shows you that the employees of nurses are the largest source of complaints into the Board of Nursing Office, with 28%. The second largest comes from our actual licensing and certification department, and that includes the positive results from the law enforcement database, LIDS checks that we do on all the applications, as well as any applications that we get where the nurse self-discloses that she's had a criminal records check. So that is about 18% of our complaints. The fourth source of complaints come from consumers or family members of patients. And the fourth largest is other nurses filing a complaint, co-workers of nurses. And that makes up 11%.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, Representative Nathanson, please.
Thank you. One detailed question. How does it count if the family is the employer? Directed.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, my name is Kim. For the record, my name is Kim Kerbering, and I'm the Program Executive for Compliance Investigation. We would count that as the employer because they are complaining on that basis as someone they have employed. We have the patient complaints for the person who is receiving the care, and we would consider them the patient, if you will, and mark them accordingly.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The next slide that we have talks about the complaint types, and that's on the next page. It's two pages behind the pie chart that you just had. Mm-hmm. And this talks about the conduct complaints that we get in the office. And as you can see, again, the number one type of complaint we get is substance abuse. And those are complaints against nurses who have drug or alcohol problems. The second is abuse and neglect of patients.
Is that in hospital, John?
It's hospitals, nursing homes, community-based care settings.
Okay.
All settings. Third, I think, is a failure to perform duties. That something was ordered and was not carried out. The fourth one would be falsification of applications. And the fifth is medication administration. And then you can see from the list here on this table the other types of conduct complaints that come into the board office. And the table behind that actually gives you the numbers that we're talking about.
So do you think we have a system in the state now by which if a nurse gets into trouble in terms of drug abuse that they could feel comfortable to come to the association? Or what is the system by which they can do that?
Yes, Madam Chair, what we have in place now is the Nurse Monitoring Program, and that is a voluntary and confidential program for individuals who have either substance abuse issues or mental health or, in fact, physical abuse, or not abuse issues, but impairment issues that would hamper their ability to practice safely. They can come forward and work with us in monitoring how they are practicing nursing. And we have been, as part of our outreach program over this last year, we've been going around the state and making people more and more aware of its availability and working with educating employers, too, as to their role within that program.
So as I said, you know, that the costs to this program are mostly for the investigative costs and that we incur due to staffing in this area.
Sure.
Can I just ask one question?
Yes.
Why do you think that you have such a high number of CNAs who are dealing with issue of abandonment and neglect and that kind of stuff? Is the training an appropriate training to help deal with these issues, or because this is during the course of a year, from what I can see, but that's a lot in the course of a year.
If I may respond to that, Madam Chair, I think with respect to the CNA population, a lot of it has to do with the setting that they're working in and the demands that are being placed on them and the frustrations, if you will, for them in having a very high patient load to be managing and taking care of. They are, in some respects, probably the most overworked, underpaid, although probably others might argue with that point. But that is a real difficulty with that population. Is the challenges they face, I believe, in the work site. That can then translate to violations of the Nurse Practice Act and then therefore coming to our attention.
That is much too high.
Madam Chair, I know you asked us a whole lot of questions, but in interpreting some of these graphs, it's difficult. On your conduct complaints, are these complaints filed or complaints verified and investigated?
These are, if I may respond, these are the complaints that come in the door. What we do when a complaint is made is that we log it, we characterize it in terms of its source and its type of complaint. The characterization of the complaint may or may not be what actually happened, or perhaps what is a disciplinary sanction, as we have no requirement, if you will, that the person calling to make the complaint be well-versed in the Nurse Practice Act to know precisely what they're complaining of. So, for example, we may have a complaint of a documentation error. They didn't write it down. Well, in fact, they didn't write it down because they didn't do it. And we would look at that as a failure to perform the duty. So we do take that into account as you come out the other end of the process, if you will, in terms of what the disciplinary sanction is. But this is how we characterize them as they're coming in the door, and then we track them through the process.
Thank you.
It may be helpful for others, too, if we had the total number of certified medical assistants and certified nursing assistants, so that we know, you know, how this context is, because when you look at if we're talking about the CNAs, you know, we've got 12 cases of abandonment, 63 abuse and neglect, 33 arrests. I mean, things like that, it would be easier to see in context if we know out of how many total we're talking about.
And if I may respond, Representative Boone, we had earlier in the information.
Okay, I see.
Yes, the full percentage.
Okay.
Generally, to make a very generalized statement, we get complaints on approximately 1% of our population. So, you know, what that tells us is that 99% are doing quite well, and the public should have the utmost confidence in them. And we're dealing with the 1% that are our problems.
You will. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I mean, we can't say that message enough, because when we try to say that when we're out there giving presentations, that 99% of the nurses and the nursing assistants are doing a great job out there taking care of our Argonians, but we happen to see the other 1%, and because it is a driving factor for our budget, that's why we're reporting it to you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morrison?
Well, the other thing is, it's the 1% that is a public safety issue, and it's the 1% that could cause a death for the patient, and it's the 1% that run amok, sometimes several times in a row, and so the 1% are the ones that I'm more interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, unfortunately, that's the way it is. But, you know, you're dealing with 50,000 or so people up there, and the 1%. But those are, you know, how many people are in prison? Well, the percentage of the population, and those are the people we have to worry about. The good guys we don't worry about.
Senator Borden?
Thank you. It would be helpful to me to have a better understanding of the distinction between three of the categories, the distinction of what counts in a certain category. I'm looking at abuse, neglect, and then misconduct toward patient and client, family, dignity, rights. You know, one could ask the question, well, I'll let you respond to that first question, the distinction.
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, you raise a good point. Those are distinctions. Those are very fine distinctions. It's very easy to say all of the behavior that you've mentioned would constitute abuse, would constitute neglect. What that doesn't give us, what we're trying to do, is get a more refined sense of what the issue was. Was it that they were being rude? Was it that they were letting them sit in soiled depends? Was it, we're trying to get a more refined sense of exactly what that is. And frankly, as we keep moving forward, we keep trying to refine it more and more. It helps inform us, frankly, as to what the education component of the board's responsibility should be doing. It all kind of meshes together, if you will. So we do try and keep that. As to what they truly mean, a dignity question might be more of a verbal comment. A misconduct may be a very inappropriate joke. They weren't intending any harm, perhaps, but in fact what they said was not funny, wasn't taken as funny. Abuse and neglect tend to be more of the actual physical manifestations of the conduct, and when I say that, I mean on the patient.
Madam Chair.
Senator, who's that?
Thank you. Whose job is it to make sure that the people who you certify understand what these fine distinctions are? I mean, when is a joke inappropriate? Yeah, I mean, where's the orientation? Is it up to the staff person in charge of the people to do that? Who does the orientation?
Senator Chair.
So I knew I was going to do that at least once. Madam Chair, Senator Rosa. Maybe more than once, so I'll apologize in advance.
That is a combination of what they're taught within their training or education. They are responsible for knowing what our rules are, and in our rules we list out specifically what constitutes misconduct. And then the employers themselves go through an orientation period of what is expected within the performance of their duties.
Okay. May I follow up?
You may.
Getting back to Senator Gordley's question, the fine lines and distinctions, mm-hmm. I mean, are these, you know, it's kind of hard to deal with all of the minutiae when you're doing the instruction, but I imagine that there's enough time during the orientation where there is a discussion about the fine lines.
If I may answer that, my sense is yes, they do. I don't know if they describe it in those specific terms. We try and correlate our list here to what our rules are for violations, and then in terms of characterizing them, that actually falls to me.
Okay.
So we have one.
May we have a list of the? What do you have? Can we see what you have in terms of your? Are they listed in here? What your rules and how that?
Do we give them a nurse practice act?
And what?
Yeah. We can provide you with a copy of the nurse practice act.
That would be helpful.
And we have conduct derogatory to the standards, as the buzz phrase, if you will, for both the RN-LPN population as well as the CNA population, and it lists out the behaviors that are considered misconduct.
Thank you.
So, happy to.
Madam Chair, Senator Marcet, we also use this list to help teach when we go to the nursing education programs. And we also use this list when we go out and do outreach to the nurses throughout the state. We give them examples of some kinds of complaints that we get. These are the complaints that to somebody has risen to a level that they want to make a complaint to the board. So this isn't us saying that there's necessarily a violation, but these are the complaints that come in the door and that someone has felt that whatever the behavior was, it was inappropriate or harmful.
Now, may I just...
You may have
one more time. We're going to go through several orientations every year, sexual harassment. The legislators, we sit down and we take time, and someone walks us through all of the actions and the subtleties that may occur, so there is no misunderstanding about where the line is. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we're getting at. I don't know, mm-hmm. you know, that's mm-hmm. the person who conducts that knows those. I don't know if you have all that written down in terms of all of these rules.
If I may, what we do is we set the standard for what they should be taught to, and they should be taught what the boundaries between patient and caregiver are. The employer, though, does have a role in then supervising that they maintain those boundaries, if you will, and may then elaborate it even further with respect to their own facilities policy. They work together, if you will.
Thank you. Is there any double counting in the conduct complaints that we're looking at? I've a page ahead. And, for example, looking at the category of competence, and again trying to understand the distinction that you're making.
If I may, I was dead serious there when I said it falls on me to make those distinctions. Mm-hmm. At the conclusion, we only categorize it once on our computer. We have a primary, and then we can have subparts. Again, this is part of our continuing process of trying to refine the information, but it's only assigned a number one, and that's what, one, I should say, mm-hmm. and that's what's reflected here. So we are trying to build a database so we can parse it down to even greater depths, but it's counted once.
It would be interesting, Madam Chair, to have a deeper understanding of what defines competence or incompetence, which mm-hmm. that's the question. Mm-hmm. What fits in that category when you have all these other categories?
If I may, it may just be more of a general, they're not doing a lot of things right. It's not really a matter of they're not getting their documentation right, or they're not being polite, or they are being sloppy in their procedures. It may be all of those together, and it seems to be best described as a general competency issue rather than saying, no, this was just a documentation issue case. It can be challenging because they don't come to us in nice little bundles. We have to figure out, you know, kind of what does seem to be the primary and dominant fact here.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It
could be a pattern.
And it could be a pattern, right.
Thank you, Nancy.
So you know there's a pattern of practice with it. Give him a chance. Or he just knows whether there's a pattern of practice in there.
If we have someone who's presented to us initially for what seems to be a relatively minor infraction and that they're just not getting their documentation done, say, in a timely fashion, we will try and remediate that. The board will try and say, what's the problem? Take an education class on this. Learn how to do this right. And they won't impose a discipline sanction. But if this is the third time they're coming to us and they're just not getting it, they're either incapable of getting it or they're refusing to get it, then the board is going to start ratcheting up and going, moving into a more disciplinary process. Ultimately to revocation, if that's what it takes. I mean, if someone's just really not getting it, they need to stop practicing and the board will revoke them. But again, that's based on the pattern that has been developing rather than one serious right. incident.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll move on next to another program of the board, and that is accreditation of nursing education and training programs. And this has been an area that is constantly changing, it seems like, in the last couple of years in Oregon. And here on this chart, I'm kind of giving on the screen, I'm trying to give you an idea of how nursing education has changed in Oregon in the last few years, from 2000 to 2006. In 2000, there were no just standalone practical nurse programs in the state. They were all part of an ADN program. Today, there are 5 LPN programs, and these are purely LPN programs. And that seems to be what the trend is. And it's interesting because it used to be that all the LPN programs were the first year of an ADN program. So all the LPN programs were in the community colleges. But what we are seeing now is as the ADN programs move into different models of education, proprietary programs are coming, are starting in the state to take care of that void that is left. So we have now five standalone PN programs, whereas 2000 we had none. And four of those five are proprietary programs and not in the community colleges. And I think the reason that the nurse educators in this state kind of decided to go that way is because Oregon has the lowest number of LPNs per capita in anywhere in the United States. And so they were asking, why was that happening? And when we had the PN programs that were the first year of an ADN program, what was happening is that the LPNs were actually just people who were in the first year of the program waiting to get into the second year of the program, and they'd get licensed in LPN after their first year so they could work their way through school the second year, but they really had no intention of staying as an LPN. So even though we had numbers of LPNs, they were moving on within a year to continue in the second year of the RN program. Also, because the admissions to ADN programs are so competitive, I think they felt that there were a lot of applicants that would make very good LPNs that weren't able to get into the ADN programs, and so we were losing a lot of good potential applicants. Also, I think that they felt that trying to design an ADN curriculum and an LPN curriculum at the same time was also very difficult for both for the programs. So that is why the effort started to happen with the standalone practical nurse programs.
Madam Chair, I have no idea where we are. Are we in the same supplement or a different supplement, or do we have those slides?
In part three of your material,
we do have. I have on supplement one, we have the presentation, and we're kind of going through that presentation and that
the slide about the growth of nursing programs.
Is in part three.
We did not provide this one separately.
Okay.
So we're in part one.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry, this is so confusing. We are doing part one of the presentation, which is, you know, the key budget drivers. Then the supplemental material for the information that we're presenting here is mostly in part one of the supplemental materials. Then we're going to go on to performance measurements, and that will be part two. And then we're going to go into our policy package, which has a lot to do with discipline. So that supplemental material is in part three, and that's why we went there. But probably the best way to follow along with what's happening on the screen here is the presentation, the narrative to the presentation. And we'll organize it differently next time.
So I think we just have to listen very well. Your question, I'm sorry.
No, I was just trying to figure out where the narrative. I'm sorry.
The narrative is in the first part of your book.
Okay.
Oh, we're back in the book now.
Okay.
I'm with Senator Morris today.
I'm sorry. The supplemental follow. Materials, part one.
Yeah.
There's a presentation, the narrative, and we're actually going through this narrative now. Right.
Okay. Okay. So you're on.
Right, and we're actually on the second page. We're not making a lot of progress, but lots of good questions are coming. But we're on the second page. We're under C, Accreditation of Nursing Education and Training Programs. So I was just kind of trying to give you an idea of what was happening with nursing education in the state, and we felt that this graph kind of best described it.
Well, you certainly can't say this committee doesn't observe.
And ask good questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rye.
That brings up another. For some of our newer members and those of us that haven't been real close,
oh, yeah.
The continued use of acronyms gets my head whirling.
Okay.
if some of our guests could be a little more descriptive in regards to something they're referring to, I'd certainly appreciate it.
Please, ma'am.
Well, put
Madam Chair and Representative Guard, please stop me when we do that, and I'll try to be much more cognizant of that. So, nurses are terrible. Nurses do a lot of nursing talk. And, so I will.
Well, you guys don't need a motivator, do you?
Oh, the penny pot?
Yeah, that's right. We'll have to go get Senator Wetter's pig jar.
She's listening. She may send it.
Probably keeping track of it, you know.
Thank you.
So, okay, well, I'll go on to the second column that just shows the ADN programs with the PN options.
And explain
The ADN is Associate Degree of Nursing, okay? And the PN is Practical Nurses. So in order to be a practical nurse, you only have to have 1 year of education. To be an Associate Degree Nurse, you have to have 2 years of education.
So we have a big community college program. And BSN are your 4-year degree program.
Is a BSN is a baccalaureate degree. So in the second column, it shows you that the programs, associate degree programs with the first year that had the PN option are decreasing. But the PN programs are increasing, so that's going to actually give us more LPNs than we had before. Then the associate degree nurses nursing programs are increasing. One additional associate degree nurse program was added at the Oregon Coast, at the Oregon Coast Community College. And in 2006, there are 4 community college programs who signed an agreement with the Oregon Consortium of Nursing Education, which is an agreement with OHSU, where the associate degree nurses can take 2 years of nursing, and they can exit and take the RN exam at that time, or they can stay on the community college campus and get their baccalaureate degree through OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University. There are more associate degree programs that are going to be joining the consortium, but for right now there are 4 of them.
How many are we graduating a year now?
We are, that's going to be in one of our performance measurements, but we're almost up to 1,000 nurses that were graduating out of the Oregon nursing programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you break that down to the number of graduating from the 4-year programs and from the 2-year programs? They're both obviously, once they graduate, whether it's 2-year or 4-year, they become registered nurses and have all the same rights and privileges. Also, could you give us an explanation, if possible, why the graduates from the 2-year programs are passing the national examination at over an 85% rate across the board, mm-hmm. and 3 of our schools with a 4-year program are not passing 85%, are in one with 63, one at 78, and one at 80, and give me the relative cost of those programs. I mean, if you go to a 4-year program, what it costs versus the output from a 2-year program, what it costs, and why there's a graduation rate, the pass rate for the national exam is lower at the 4 years than it is at the 2 years.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, again, the one question I can't answer is what are the cost of the nursing education programs? And I don't know that. I can get that information, but I don't know that today. In terms of the NCLEX examinations, the national examination that they take, all registered nurses, whether they're 2-year or 4-year, take the same national exam. And that this has been an issue of debate and dialogue in the nursing profession. Why do the associate degree nurses do better in the national exams and the baccalaureate programs? The national exam is based on a job analysis, so they go in and they test nurses who are actually in the job to see what are the knowledge and skills that they use in that job. And that's what the national exam is based on. Then baccalaureate programs will say that a lot of what they teach best in the last 2 years of their 4-year program is about leadership, decision-making, critical judgment, and they feel that the national exam does not reflect those kinds of skills in the testing situation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
Is it possible to take the exam after 2 years and then go on for a baccalaureate? Do you have to take it again after the baccalaureate?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, you may take the national exam after 2 years and become a registered nurse, and then if you go on to get your baccalaureate degree, you do not have to take it again.
Ma'am, just has does have some relevance. I'm not sure how much, but it has some relevance. Most of these programs are publicly supported programs. Taxpayer dollars go into them. It's always been a concern to me that this is sort of a consistent pattern we see. It's not directly in the control of the board, obviously. They just give us the information. But it gives me pause. It always has given me pause of why the two-year programs seem to score so well as exam. The four-year programs, which you'd think would outperform them on the exam, in fact, fall behind them. Just doesn't, intuitively, doesn't seem right to me. And frankly, when I'm on the floor working with nurses, I get my head taken off of this one. I can't tell a big difference between the two- and four-year program graduates. I just, maybe it's there and I'm missing it. I don't go around and check them off, but there's no obvious huge change from a 2 to 4 year graduate to me in most cases. I do see a need for the 4 year graduates, especially, to become instructors and to help train more students. I think they have a real ability to do that, but I don't know. It just seems strange. It intuitively seems strange to me.
In that case, when I was working in the community college as a counselor, we did a study. A study was done in academia. That's probably why this is outside of them, because this is a nursing association of people who are in basically hospitals, but on the academic end of things, the study was done regarding those students graduating from a two-year nursing program versus a four-year. And I don't want to mention numbers now because it was some time ago since I've been retired, 5-6 years now, so I don't want to speculate on that. But if that's information that you guys are interested in, we certainly can have someone come in, because that is a workforce issue. And while we're not hearing workforce in this committee, if that's something you're interested in, then what I will do is have that information.
And it's possible that 40 nurses are not being tested fairly for the 2 years. They may be preparing for different fields that I'm missing here. So I'm not saying this is bad. It's like, it seems strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator Gordon and then Senator Morrison.
Thank you. I appreciate the question that Senator Bates has raised, and it leads me to want to know more about the quality of the programs being offered. How the quality can be compared, contrasted in the two-year institutions versus the four-year programs. And then in the end, we're talking about the quality of the product coming out of those institutions. I would hope that this is a discussion that carries over into the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee.
Right.
Where there is or should be a focus on the quality of all of the programs that public dollars are invested in, community colleges, higher ed. I think this is a quality question, and someone somewhere hopefully is having the conversation that can better answer the questions that are being raised here.
Senator Carter and Senator Gordley, those are questions that are being debated in the nursing community. I think that, in general, the nursing community uses the baccalaureate nurses for leadership and management and knowing and more the associate degree for direct care nurses. And I think that they believe that the national exam is not testing for some of the things that the baccalaureate nurses do very well. Having said that, the only way we have to monitor anything is through the national exam. And I think that probably surveys to the employers of nurses to see how they feel about the graduates of the nursing education program is going to be the best way to get that information.
So is it a follow-up? Are you aware of efforts to conduct such a survey?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I am not aware of that, although I would not be surprised if it is happening. I'm not aware of it right now. I think that each school, however, I do know that each school does a survey of their graduates and they're in constant communication with employees of nurses of asking for feedback on their graduates and how they're doing out there. So I think each individual school has it. I don't know if it's a statewide measure.
The overarching issue from where I sit is one of performance, measuring the performance and outcomes, the products coming out of these, out of our public institutions, be they community colleges or the universities. And if we can't answer the question, then that's problematic at this level. It's a problem.
Thank you very much. Ms. John?
Okay. Oh.
Is it on this education piece?
No. Well,
Senator Morissette?
Okay, I just have one quick comment. It seems to me that if people are tested after 2 years, there would be a leveling of the field. Everyone would probably do the same achievement. The baccalaureate program, I have six relatives who are nurses, none of whom work in hospitals. One is a school nurse. I mean, they're doing different things with the baccalaureate, and I think you get into it the second 4 years, and you're not dealing with the kinds of things you're tested for, and you forget. So I think that accounts for a lot of the differences. And I don't know that it's the bad teaching at the university level. It's just it's a different program.
Ms. John? Continue with your report. Because you guys are not on the academic end of thing. I could answer that question that since I was in education for 29 years as a counselor. We could answer that, but since this is not an education committee, I thought maybe we shouldn't get too bogged down. But these are very interesting questions because they are workforce related. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, when you think about the economics of the situation, I would be asking the same questions if I was in education. Why is it that we're getting more bang for our buck in a two-year institution that costs us less in terms of education, and we have students graduating at 85% higher than BSNs? But I thought maybe I wouldn't put you guys through this since that's not your area of expertise. Shall we continue with your report?
I would just finish that graph by saying we are increasing the baccalaureate programs in the state. But we had two more baccalaureate programs be accredited, and that's George Fox University and Concordia. And then we have OHSU and all their campuses and the University of Portland. And then the new kind of model of nursing education that started is the direct entry master's program. And that's interesting because these are people who have a master's degree in another field who now want to go into the profession of nursing. So they kind of go through an accelerated program, and we have two of those direct entry master's programs, one's at the University of Portland and one's at OHSU. So that is the traditional services that the board has always done, the licensing and certification, the discipline, and then the approval of schools. Now the board is also looking at more proactive services, and these include the nurse monitoring program and the more communication outreach and policy and practice consultation. The nurse monitoring program is a program that was legislatively mandated in 1991, and it's, so I think as we talked about before, it's an alternative to discipline for nurses who have had physical, mental, and substance abuse issues. And the intent of this program is to encourage individuals to self-report their substance abuse problems and impairments, and then to work on rehabilitation while they're under the oversight of the board. It's not a rehabilitation program, but its purpose is to monitor the participants closely along with the employees and the treatment providers to ensure that they're not working in situations that would create a potential safety to the public. So we're trying to save a nurse in the nursing profession as long as we can do it under supervision and guarantee to the public that they're not at risk for doing this.
staffing cost is the primary expense with this program, and as substance and alcohol abuse problems continue to increase in society, so too do they in the nursing profession, and so too do the demands for this program. The board is also committed to communicating with its licensees and stakeholders regularly. And one major effort is that we have been doing in the last year is to do outreach tours. And during the last 3 years, we have gone to all parts of the state and have done education programs for nurses in the state. And we also do a variety of programs and in-services throughout the year. And last year we reached more than 2,600 licensees and students through this outreach program. We also try to keep our website very current, and our website is a very popular place for people to come and get information from the board. In terms of consulting needs, we have formed a policy and practice consultant group to respond to the needs of licensees. It seems to me that licensees in this state are no longer just look to the Board of Nursing to license them. They also want guidance, especially out there when the healthcare environment is changing so quickly, that they are now turning to the board and asking for policy and consultation services. We have four people in this policy and practice consultant group, and it consists of an advanced practice nurse, that's like a nurse practitioner, and also a RN and LPN practice consultant, a RN and LPN education consultant, and then a CNA, which is a nursing assistant program consultant. I think the board in some ways is becoming more of a knowledge-based organization for their licensees. They're looking to us to help them, you know, kind of navigate through the changes in the nursing care arena. You know, they want, is it against the Nursing Practice Act to do a certain procedure? You know, who can administer anesthetic agencies or anesthetic agents? I think another example of policies that nurses are asking for have to do with the cosmetic procedures now. You know, can a nurse give Botox? You know, can she run a medical spa? That kind of thing. So, and Dr. Bates is shaking his head. But there are all kinds of scope of practice questions that come to the board as scope is expanding and as the healthcare arena is changing out there. Then there's also factors that are affecting our licensing services, and I think that nurses are expecting 24/7 information from the board, and they're also wanting to be able to access the board's verification line, for example, to find out whether nurses are currently licensed and whether they're in good standing.
Should this be a part of continuing education in terms of one's ability to practice in hospitals? And somewhere along the line, it would appear to me that this is a natural extension of what a person does in the hospital setting. So is this a part of continuing education?
Sandra Carter, this is one way that nurses could expand their scope of practice is to get additional education and training. But sometimes nurses are asked to practice way beyond their scope of practice. And sometimes nurses don't know where the line is, you know, and when are they exceeding their scope of practice, and when are they within their scope of practice, or if they get more continuing education, can they expand their scope of practice in that way? So I think those are the questions that the nurses have when they're on the floor.
Mm-hmm. But I think it would appear to me, members, that if a person is going to be working in a hospital where technology is constantly changing, it would appear to me that that's not an additional course, but a continuing part of their awareness. And I understand you're going to a more knowledge-based kind of activity because technology is driving that. So shouldn't that be a natural component, even if they decided not to specialize? It just appeared to me, I know if I go in the hospital and doctors are using modern-day technology and nurses don't know how to do it, I'm going to ask some questions.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Ms. Bouchard, could you please maybe explain a little bit about what scope of practice means, and that might help provide some context to what you mean when somebody is asked to do things outside of their scope of practice?
Senator Carter and members of the committee, each licensee is educated in the program to be able to perform within that license certain procedures.
It's hard to explain. Maybe as a point of comparison, if I can just jump in here, Joan. For example, surgery would be considered outside scope of a nurse. They're not trained to do that. They're not permitted to do that. And I'm expecting to actually see Dr. Bates over there shaking his head, yes, that is true. And it's often as a point of comparison that we understand the scopes of practice better. Essentially, practicing nursing involves assessing patients, help doing nursing diagnosis in terms of what seems to be appropriate, recording the information, getting the care plans designed for what should be happening next, and oftentimes that does include bringing it forward to another provider to say, it is outside of my scope, if you will, to prescribe the antibiotic that this person needs. That can only be done by a physician or nurse practitioner. So that they have this realm, if you will, of their responsibilities within their scope. And I don't know if I've clarified or confused, but what we have seen with that is, as part of the nursing shortage, people are trying to find more and more creative ways to use their nurses. And as that happens, they go outside of kind of the more traditional, we understand where our boundaries are here, roles, and are asked to go into other roles, and that's when it starts getting a little unclear for them. And they will contact us and say, this isn't a traditional thing that an RN or an LPN would do, but is it appropriate? Does that help?
And one of the things that this policy group has done is to establish a decision tree, because we at the Board of Nursing can't sit there and answer telephone calls saying, oh, yes, you can do this procedure, no, you can't do this procedure. What they need to do is just to think through the process. Do I have the education and training to do it? Have I been trained in this specific procedure? Is that training documented in my personnel file? Do I feel confident doing this? So we try to give them a framework of decision making so that they can decide when people are asking them to do something that may be out of their scope of practice, to decide whether they are competent to do that or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I can offer a little light on a very difficult subject. This problem cuts both ways as far as scope of practice is concerned for nurses. We have a shortage of nurses, and we have some high-tech positions in hospitals. But let me give you an example of what can go wrong and why a nurse could be asked to do something that he or she may feel uncomfortable doing. And this actually, I'll give you a case that actually has happened. You have a situation where you may have a number of emergent surgical cases you had to perform on a given day. And those patients post-operatively should go to the surgical floor, where there's nurses trained to care for surgical post-op patients and feel comfortable with them, monitoring the oxygen, assessing the patient, calling a physician when something is not going right. But more commonly we like to see it now, that floor is swamped. We have a shortage of nurses. They can't call anybody in. On the medicine floor, there might be a couple of beds available. So they'll send a couple of post-surgical patients to the medical floor, which you think are of lower need post-surgically. The nurse receiving those patients might feel very uncomfortable. He or she might feel, I'm not really trained to take care of post-surgical patients. And in a similar fashion, you might have a situation occur where you have patients who are coming in for medical reasons, congestive heart failure, pneumonia, going to the surgical floor, and the nurse there feeling the same way. We're seeing this more and more in our hospitals because of our nursing shortage. Hospitals are trying to respond to it. They have very clear rules about what the privileges are for any given staff member, and it's very tight and gotten tighter over the last few years, trying to resolve these issues. Who can assist in surgery? Who can close up a patient after surgery? What procedures can a nurse get involved in doing? So hospitals are trying to do this, but the underlying factor here, I believe, is a lack of nurses. Mm-hmm. And that's where scope of practice really can get very difficult sometimes, and nurses get in a situation they feel extremely uncomfortable in. and field patients are being risked. And there have been some serious problems because of that. I think that's what you're thinking about, too. Outside the hospital setting, we have other issues with surgical practice. There are concerns about lack of primary care and nurses being asked to step up and doing more and more primary care. Some of them feel uncomfortable doing that. And there's cases where nurses kind of went overbound and thought they could do something they shouldn't be doing. And patients end up in emergency rooms after hours. Who took care of you? So there's all kinds of issues out there because of nursing shortages, primary care shortages, and the pressures on the system. So your question is right on. The answers are not easy. But I think as we ramp up and resolve our nursing shortage, which I hope we do, these problems will become less and less and less. But you're absolutely right. There are some serious scope of practices questions here. And the times we put nurses in positions that are bad for them and bad for the patient. And I don't know the answer to that right now. So get more nurses.
Okay, my question is, why do you allow hospitals to take a candy striker and make that person a surgical technician? And not certified, not even tested, not licensed. You're taking people off the floor and putting them in to an operating room and having them be the lead person. Why?
And Senator Cordner and Senator Morissette, I think that the whole thing comes down to making sure that the person which is doing the procedure or the assignment is competent to do it. And what's happening out there with some of the nursing shortage is that nurses are being asked to do things that they don't feel trained or competent to do. And
well,
and I think that there's also a huge issue out there with unlicensed personnel.
And if I may add to that, we don't regulate hospitals, as was just
pointed out. But you regulate providers of people who provide services, and a surgical technologist is not licensed, not certified, can be taken off a candy striper and say, come on into the surgery room and hand me my instruments. That's huge.
Yes.
And it's a gap, and you guys should be dealing with that.
I know they don't like it because it takes away from.
Oh, okay.
I'll add that the nurses fought us certifying technology. Yeah. They fought us all the way.
Right.
I think they're changing a little bit now. But that is a gap in certification, and it's a very important thing.
And Santa Marta, you're exactly right. It's a huge issue out there. You know, who's doing what?
Mm-hmm.
Who's doing what in hospitals? And all kinds of different names for different kinds of technicians, and no one is quite sure sometimes what's happening out there. We don't regulate facilities, so but it's a huge issue that nurses are talking about as well.
Representative Boone.
Well, yeah, as long as we're tangenting off track, I'll throw a little bomb out too. And I'd like to know what if any, dealing with or management of when we have an emergency, and I mean we're talking big time emergency, a big event, huge event, and I go back to the MASH model. You do what you can, do what you see, do what you saw in CSI last night or whatever, but or House. Are the nurses that you regulate, all the levels of nurses that you regulate, are they somehow protected under the Good Samaritan Act or liability for if there's a huge emergency and you need to just grab any warm body and say, here, hold this, get that, and they kind of know what things are, but it may be well beyond their scope of practice to even assist at that level. But what's the scenario when that happens?
This is not good when we both look at each other to answer that question.
Take a stab. I can tell you that nurses are covered under the Good Samaritan law.
Yeah.
They,
okay.
But, you know, they're expected, again, to practice within their scope of practice no matter what.
Mm-hmm. But thank you. That's a great answer. Very diplomatic.
And so, Representative Nathans?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that the slide on the screen is about factors affecting licensing services. There's something that I don't know whether you're going to be telling us about. I'm going to have a question about, the pages aren't numbered in our packet, but let's say about two-thirds of the way through Supplement 1, there's a table that says licenses renewed in fiscal year 05-06, and
I guess one thing I would ask would be, how do I interpret these numbers when I think about workforce, availability of nurses, all of your licensees? We see numbers on how many licenses were reactivated and how many were renewed. But I'd be curious to know how many people dropped out, left the profession, and how many were denied, for example. So did everyone who applied for a renewal get a renewal? So that I'd like to understand the context of those numbers. And that doesn't have to be right now if you don't have the information.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson.
I'm Pat Miles, the business manager. I've dealt in a lot of these statistics, so that's why I'm going to answer your question. We weren't planning on going through most of the statistical information in your Part 1. This is for your information. But if I might, renewals are just what they sound like, a two-year renewal on the person's birthday. And we get a few that do not qualify. They must meet a practice requirement. But the majority of those who submit an on-time renewal are renewed.
As long as they don't have we put them through the LEDS check, the criminal records check, so they can't have criminal records check and they have to have worked 960 hours in the past 5 years. But if they can meet those two requirements right now in Oregon, they can get renewed.
So generally speaking, those who renew and those who reactivate make it through the process fairly equal. On new licenses, however, there are certain license types with a significant, shall we say, dropout rate between application and issue. With testing, particularly the CNA pass rates you've seen elsewhere in the packet, there are probably, depending on the year, 10 to 20% of the people who will not follow through the entire process.
Then that's something I would like to hear more about at some point. I'm concerned not only about the supply of nurses, and I'll just use that as a generic term, all the groups that you license, that the workforce that we have available to take care of the needs of the citizens of Oregon, but also understanding what accounts for this attrition rate. Why are people not wanting to follow through or unable to follow through, and can we help in some regard? Thank you.
John, why don't you just finish this sheet, one other sheet or whatever, so that just go to 2:30 because another group needs to hear it 3 and they like it sound.
Right. So we're just talking about factors affecting services, nurses, and employees of nurses are demanding the services of the board, and they want us to be very quick and efficient. So we have gone to online renewals for nurses, so it's a very quick process to get nurses renewed their license. We've also set up a customer's call center so that when people call the office, they can talk to people and get their answers. Get their questions answered without having to go into voicemail and have people call back. And that's been also very effective for us, as well as having a 24/7 verification line. So any employee of nurses can call the line or to go on our website. Now we have it on our website as well to find out if a nurse is licensed or not, if she has a current license, and if that license is in good standing. So. And then finally, you know, one of the proactive programs for the board is just to involve as many stakeholders as we can in our public policy decisions. Those are some of the stakeholders that we consider with the Board of Nursing. And we're doing as much as possible to include these stakeholders. We have advisory committees for all our administrative rules. And also we're trying to webcast our board meetings. And we video conference all our task forces, and that has allowed us to get much more input from the rural areas. I know somebody from Pendleton or Baker City can't necessarily come to a task force meeting if they have to travel and lose 2 days, but they can go down to their conference room and come on to the video conference and give us the rural perspective of the issues that we're dealing with, and that's been very helpful to us.
Glad to hear that.
So, I'm sorry it felt so disorganized and how we organized it, but that is essentially is, you know, some of the environmental context in which the Board of Nursing is function under at this time. So.
We have a lot of questions today, and I just think that it was necessary for us to get through today, and I need people getting engaged in the process. And Senator Morissette being able to be a representative Boone. That's my plan on this evening.
Well, I have just a quick comment, and wondered, because a constituent of mine asked me this last session, and I didn't, it didn't go anywhere, but, and I honestly can't remember what I was told by probably Lauren or Brian back there, or Martin. And that is, I was talking about, she's a retired nurse, retired RN, interested in getting back into practice without going back to school. And we did something around rural doctors who are retired and giving some volunteer work in clinics and things like that, and sort of help out where needed, where people were lower staffed. And I don't think she was talking about doing surgery. I think she's talking about helping out where needed in high traffic areas, maybe school clinics or hospital clinics or community clinics, something like that. Is there any provision that exists or could be implemented to allow someone to come back into practice part-time, and get them back in to help while this shortage is filled in?
Representative Boone, there's several things that are going on. First of all, there's a reentry program for nurses who have been out of practice for a long time. Maybe they left the profession to go raise kids, and they've been out in 10 years, and they want to come back in. So we have reentry programs for them. We also have a registry of retired nurses who they can go on and register and still get all the information from the board, and they can, work at, a clinic or something if they want to do that.
So something is in place.
As long as, you have to have a current license in order to do that.
Right. But the retraining or the reentry thing, is that, how long period is that?
I think it's 80 hours. There's four programs in the state to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions?
Well, Madam Chair, this is a wonderful resource. Thank you for making it available. Our constituents will find this information in this form to be very helpful. I take note that this was prepared by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. That means you played a leadership role in making sure that this got done, and I want to acknowledge and honor that.
Thank you. And it's on our website as well.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Okay, anything other than Thursday? That's right. We'll see you again tomorrow.
All right.
Good job.